Good evening. My name's Carton Rogers. I'm the Vice Provost and Director of Libraries here at Penn. I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. This is the second of a three-part lecture series entitled American Pie, the Politics of Food in the 21st Century. This series is sponsored by the Penn Libraries through the Muriel Felser Bodek Public Affairs Fund. This fund was established in 2001 by Gordon S. Bodek, a longtime Penn supporter, member of the Board of Trustees, graduate of the college in 1942, who established the fund in honor of his wife, Muriel. This fund generously supports lectures on current public affairs. I see that Gordon and Muriel's son, Hanley, is in the audience this evening. Hanley, you want to wave to the crowd, and thank you very much for you and your family's support of this great lecture series. I'd also like to take advantage of being up here with a microphone and thank my colleague, Lynn Farrington, from the library's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. She's the real mastermind and organizer of this series. As one of our curators in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library, she's been deeply involved with our various food-related collections, including the Esther Oresti Collection of Rare Books on the Culinary Arts, the Library of the Philadelphia Society for Promoting Agriculture, and the Chef Fritz Blanc Culinary Archive and Library. I hope you're aware that over the last few years, the Penn Libraries has become the epicenter of food studies in the Philadelphia area, mostly through a series of incredible gifts that have really increased our holdings in this really interesting area. Through her interactions with faculty and students working in these collections, Lynn has recognized the growing interest in food studies at Penn and has been instrumental in fostering cross-disciplinary discussions on the subject and developing the website Food Studies at Penn, which you can find with a simple Google search. Attesting to this campus-wide interest in issues of food, American Pie is co-sponsored by the School of Veterinary Medicine, the School of Nursing, and the School of Arts and Sciences Nutrition Minor, the Department of History and Sociology of Science, Agatston Urban Nutrition Initiative, which is part of the Netter Center for Community Partnerships, the Environmental Kitchen at Penn Women's Center, the Penn Vegan Society, and Penn Appetit, which, in their words, is the University of Pennsylvania's innovative student-run magazine covering all things food. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I just want to remind you of the third and final lecture in this series, which will be held next Tuesday, April 24th, at 6 p.m. in Claudia Cohen Hall. Dr. John Eichard, Professor Emeritus of Agricultural Economics at the University of Missouri, will present on the future of food. Sustainable agriculture is not optional. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce this evening's speaker, Dr. Alan Kelly. Dr. Kelly received his veterinary medical education at Bristol University in England and then came to Penn to pursue a PhD in pathology. He joined the faculty in the Department of Pathobiology at the Veterinary School in 1968, where he taught pathology and established himself as a renowned researcher on muscle disease and muscular dystrophy. He authored more than 100 book chapters and scientific papers, and in 1974, he was the recipient of the Lindbeck Award for Distinguished Teaching. Dr. Kelly served as chairman of the school's Department of Pathobiology from 1994, and in 1994 became dean of the School of Veterinary Medicine and served in this office for the ensuing 12 years, retiring in December of 2005. During his deanship, Dr. Kelly raised $127 million for the Hill Pavilion, this new teaching and research building that we're meeting in this evening. And more importantly, as the director of libraries, had the vision to create a new veterinary school library here in the Hill Pavilion. And I was telling him before we got started tonight that I've used that this wonderful new library in this building as leverage on some of the other deans here at Penn as we talk about trying to renovate their library spaces. Dr. Kelly has introduced a course on global health for veterinary students and has led the Penn Vet World Award and Student Inspiration Award competitions. He also chairs the National Academy of Sciences Study on Workforce Needs in Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Kelly will be speaking this evening on the challenges faced by agriculture as it expands production to meet society's growing needs while conserving the environment, controlling the spread of infectious diseases, and accommodating to the vagaries of climate change. Please join me in welcoming Dean Emeritus and Professor of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Alan Kelly.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted to be here this evening. Thank you all for coming. I must say the library have done a phenomenal job in advertising this series. I was in a meeting in Washington, D.C. on Monday and got back relatively late, got in my car, put on NPR, and suddenly here was my name advertising this lecture series. There was nothing more potent than waking me up and rushing home to tell my wife that I'd been on NPR. I'd never been on anything like that before. I'm also very grateful to the library staff, to Carlton Rogers, and particularly to Lynn Farrington for organizing this event. And very pleased that the members of the Bodak family are here, and thank them for the support of this program. Thank you indeed. I will talk this evening about global food security, but I'm just going to talk about livestock and global food security for a variety of reasons. One, I think, and I hope I can show you, it is enormously important. Secondly, I'm a veterinarian, and you're in a building of veterinary medicine, so it's natural that I'd want to talk about that here. And thirdly, because unfortunately the livestock sector is left out in many fora where global food security are discussed and considered. There is a reasonable amount of attention paid in arable agriculture to crop genetics, etc. But livestock really don't receive enough attention. And I think it's an issue that veterinary medicine has to take up and push very hard, because the way in which livestock development proceeds in the world is enormously important. And that obviously then is the subject of my talk. I should tell you that since leaving the Dean's office, I have an office at the Center for Animal Health and Productivity, which is at New Bolton Center. And I can assure you it is very much more pleasant driving to work in Lancaster County, in Chester County, in the morning rather than coming in on 95 and into Philadelphia. So I enjoy myself out there. I have a wonderful group of colleagues. I'm also a member of the Penn Institute for Urban Research, and you will see a flavor through this talk about trying to draw attention to the need for interaction, discussion, on urban issues in food security. And indeed, we have money, Ginny Birch and Susan Wachter and members on the veterinary school, we have money for a conference that will be held. It'll be entitled something like Global Food Security and Urban Issues. And that'll be in March, the middle of March next year. So we're just beginning to plan that. So, food security, global food security. How do you supply abundant, affordable, available, and nutritious food for 9.2 billion people? It should have safe in there as well. I forgot that. So give you an idea of the dimensions of the food security problem that is in front of us. In the next 38 years, the world has to produce as much food as has been produced in the past 500 years. That's a quote from The Economist in February 2011. And it gives you an idea of the challenge that lies ahead in producing food over the next 38 years. Today, where are we in terms of food security and food insecurity? In 2009, the latest figures that I have, 925 million people were suffering from chronic hunger, and that's mostly in rural areas. In addition, there are 160 million children suffering from malnourishment, and that again is mostly in rural areas, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and in India. In many ways, that's the most cruel aspect of malnutrition, of hunger, because these children, many of them, will be stunted in physical development and intellectual development and are probably doomed to food insecurity for much of their lives. And then we have the other statistic, which is 1.5 billion people who are overweight in this world, and that includes 500 million people who are suffering from obesity. Most of them are in urban areas. Now, I'm not going to talk about the obesity problem, overweight problem, but it's another aspect of this whole problem, this whole issue. So, in many ways, it's a defining challenge of the 21st century. I see it as that, and the dilemma lies in how it should be addressed. It involves, as I've already intimated, both rural poor and urban poor. They're all food insecure, but the needs, though interrelated, are different. And that's some of the things that I want to try and point out in this lecture. But let's first start talking about the price of food. And what you can see, this is a FAO food price index for just 2011, February of this year, I think. What you can see that from roughly 2004 onwards, the price of food has progressively increased. And all of you know that, having gone to the supermarket over the last little while. Prior to that, we had a long period when the price of food was very stable and didn't increase. Now it's increasing. Plus, there have been two instances where there are food spikes. And actually, it's the food spikes, more than anything else, that have drawn the public's attention to this issue of food insecurity. So let's just drawing attention to the fact that the one distinction between rural poor and urban poor. Rural poor can produce roughly 60% of their own food. They have to buy the rest of it, whereas urban poor have to pay cash for all of their food. So they're very sensitive to the price of food. And when you see price spikes like this, it particularly affects the urban poor. So what are the reasons for the increase in price of food? Well, one is population growth. And I'm going to examine all of these in somewhat more detail in a minute. Urbanization, growth of the middle class in the global south. Failure of the global community to appropriately invest in agriculture. The biofuel industry. Five, subsidies, embargoes on grain exports, stockpiling, price speculation on global commodity markets. And finally, climate change and sustainability. So let's start with population growth. Probably many of you have seen this graph before, and it shows the progressive increase in size of populations, such as in India, as India grows to be the most populous nation on Earth. China, in fact, there's not a great deal of expansion of the population, but its impact on food insecurity is enormous. Africa, the fastest rate of population growth in the world at the moment. And then you've got a whole lot of other countries. They would include Indonesia, Bangladesh, the Middle East, many countries that are growing exceedingly rapidly as well, but I don't have statistics. And at the bottom you see that the more developed countries, we're not going to grow very much at all. So as you go from, and I should have pointed out, you go from 7 billion at present to 9.2 billion by 2050, That's an addition of 2.2 billion people. Almost all of that population growth will be in the global south, where urbanization is proceeding at an unprecedented rate. I'll give you an idea of what that means in more everyday terms. It means that every week there will be an addition of 1.1 million mouths, more mouths to feed. That's the rate of increase in the population over the next 38 years. Or put another way, it's equivalent to adding the population of Philadelphia every 11 days for the next 38 years. There's a huge increase in population growth taking place. But in fact, that was recognized. It was recognized there was going to be a significant increase in population growth. And the issue of arable land, it was presumed that there was enough arable land to feed the population. But what you see there, by 2030, available arable land will shrink by 33%. We have this large population growth. Arable land is decreasing in amount. It's going to, per person, it's going to decrease from roughly a half an acre per person to a third of an acre per person. And that's due, as I've intimated, to population growth, city expansion, but probably most important to drought and desertification in marginal lands throughout the world. We lose something like 12 million hectares of land per year just through desertification, reduced water supplies. Deforestation has to be restrained as we look forward. We can't go on cutting down trees. That has to be minimized. And what it basically means is agriculture must produce far more from less. That's the challenge that is in front of us. Now, what I said was that the demographers understood the increase in population size. What they didn't anticipate was the rate at which people are migrating from rural areas to urban areas. And that's had a huge impact. It's having a huge impact. So as you see here, urbanization will be one of the most important forces reshaping life in the 21st century. By 2050, 70% of the world's population will live in cities. UN population projects that two-thirds of the Asia's population will be urban by 2050. Here's a map of population change, demographic change in China from 1950 to 2050. And you can see, if the colors show up adequately, and it's hard to see here. Yeah, they don't show up very well, but here's your rural population progressively declining as the urban population increases, so that by 2050, you have slightly less than 400 million people in China are rural, and all the rest, about a billion, slightly less than a billion, are urban. And basically, what that means is that this population here has to produce a great deal of food, multiple supplies of food for this very large and growing population. And that's the issue of intensification, and that's an issue that we'll address throughout the talk. I don't know why the lettering doesn't conform to the circle. Certainly, they all fitted on my computer in here. however, bear with me. So, one of the things that with the growth of urbanization that it does is to change farming, because it means that farming has to become commercialized. Produce now has to be developed for distant markets. There has to be a food supply system. The food supply system has to be resilient for very large populations living in cities. Cities have only 3 or 4 days of reserve of food. So the issue of resilience, and it'll come down to a problem in climate change, the issue of resilience becomes critically important. Food has to be safe, it has to be nutritional, And above all, it has to be affordable, particularly for the poor. So one of the questions I'll ask is, can small farmers meet this burgeoning need? Now, cities are the locus of almost all economic expansion in the world. So by 2030, there will be, the projections are from the World Bank, there will be 1.2 billion middle-class people in the developing world. That's a 200% increase from 2005. And this is really a new cohort placing demands on food. And you should realize that 1.2 billion is more than the total population of the United States, Europe, and Japan combined. It's a huge increase in the numbers of people. And these people, middle class, they now have more spendable income. And when that happens, they move up the food chain. Here's a plot from USDA, Economic Research Service, showing how people will spend money as they move, as they gain a spendable income. And what the test is how would they spend an additional 10% in their income, how would they use it on purchasing food? And what you can see is that even from the poorest countries, and it basically goes from Tanzania, which is an extremely poor country, to the Philippines, Mexico, Korea, France, progressively increasing in affluence. And it doesn't make any difference. Even the poorest countries spend their money on meat and milk. That's what they want. They know they want these products because they want to give their children whole protein, complete protein, give them the best chance in life, give them the best physical development, best mental development, but also women. I mean, there's a huge problem of iron deficiency anemia amongst women in developing countries, and eating meat is one way of addressing that and solving the problem. But it's also why I said at the beginning that I only want to talk about livestock, because it brings home the point of how important livestock are in the whole issue of food security, and why I said that veterinary medicine has to take a leading role in trying to address these global issues. Now, because of this increasing demand, this increasing affluence, then there's a huge increase in demand in the developing world for animal protein. And what you see is these are figures from FAO, and it compares 1980 to 2030 in the developing world and the developed world. So meat production goes, there's an increase, there's a 560% increase in demand for meat in the developing world during these 50 years, and a 430% increase in demand for milk. Compare that with the developed world, 145% increase and 110% increase, much smaller demand from the developed world. So that means there are many more animals, livestock, poultry in the developing world. It also means there will be a lot more animal disease, and it comes back again to the issue of why veterinary medicine has such an important role to play in this whole issue of global food security. And to show you that it's an urban phenomenon, this is from China, and it shows you the progressive increase in consumption of milk from 1993 to 2002, comparing rural and urban communities. And you see this phenomenal increase in the consumption of milk in urban communities, whereas in rural areas there's virtually no change whatsoever. So this is an urban phenomenon that is increasing the demand for animal protein. And it's driven in part in China because Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao said, "I have a dream to provide every Chinese, especially children, with sufficient milk each day." They recognized, he recognized, and this is part of the party policy to increase milk production in China to provide better nutrition for Chinese citizens. So that's one side of it. What about this whole issue when we're talking about urbanization? What about poverty, urban poverty, in Asia and in Africa. So here's an issue related to Asia urbanization, and compares the urban slums and the regular urban development. And what you see in Asia is that there's a 3.54% increase in urban middle-class people, whereas slum dwellers, it's an increase of 2.2%. So actually, Asia is doing very well in moving people from abject poverty to a middle class. Nevertheless, there is still a huge number of people living in poverty in Asia. The largest number of slum dwellers in the world is in Asia. Africa is somewhat of a different story, and it's equally troubling. And you see that in Africa, there is a tremendous increase. Actually, it's the fastest growth of urbanization in the world, Africa. But as part of that, people of Africa are moving to slums. The growth of slums is phenomenal in Africa, and that's a huge concern. So when you have agencies like the World Bank and USAID, they're particularly interested in hunger in rural areas. But I think with the progress of urbanization, we have to be increasingly concerned about hunger in rural, in urban areas, and look at the comparison and the factors that lead to these disparities. So urban populations in sub-Saharan Africa, 72% of people in sub-Saharan Africa live in slums. And that's important for sociologic reasons, but it's also important for political reasons. There's a statement from the World Bank in 1990, urban poverty will become the most significant and politically explosive problem of the 21st century. And I believe that will prove to be more than true, unless we address the issue. And of course, many of you will remember that when there was the sudden food spikes in 2008, there were food riots in over 30 countries. This is a food riot you see in progress in Haiti. In fact, the Haitian government was overthrown as a result of that food riot. But I show it really for two reasons. One is that political action amongst activity amongst poor people is predominantly an urban phenomenon. It's not that common in rural areas. You get a significant political activity amongst the poor. And also because with climate change, you're likely to get increased incidence of food spikes, as we had in 2008 and 2011. So this phenomenon is something that has broad political ramifications. So of causes for increase in the price of food, the biofuel industry, and I think you all know about that, so it doesn't take, it doesn't require a great deal of discussion, except to say here now you have the price of food really tied to the price of oil, and that's a difficult issue, I think. It certainly contributed. It wasn't the only factor, but the biofuel industry certainly contributed to the food spikes in 2008. And you shouldn't think that we are, United States gets a finger pointed at us for what we do in terms of the biofuel industry, but you should know that, in fact, the biofuel industry is now expanding in Europe, particularly with the development of biodiesel, and they're importing palm oil from, particularly from Indonesia, to develop biodiesel. It is being considered in India, it's being considered in Japan, it's being considered in South Africa. So we're not going to see the end of a biofuel industry. It's going to expand. What we have to hope is that we'll get a new generation, a second generation biofuel technology that's using non-competitive products such as switchgrass to offset the loss of corn. Now, as 45% of U.S. corn, it goes to the biofuel industry. That may be a false hope on my part, because if switchgrass proves to be very effective as a a biofuel, then you may get acres and acres now devoted to switchgrass production rather than corn production. And that has to be, we have to wait to see whether that's the case. Fourth cause for the increase in the price of food were subsidies, embargoes, and price speculation. And this is a statement that many of you probably are aware of, that all of the famines in the past 150 years have been man-made and were not due to shortages in the food supply. Countries in the global north have erected protective barriers to trade and or provided subsidies to protect farmers. But what those subsidies do is to increase the price of food, and they act as a barrier for movement of and sale of foods, products from the developing world. Barriers are not going to go away, so we just have to learn to live with them in quite a number of countries, and surprisingly, they have quite broad political support even. But in emergencies, embargoes are a problem. Embargoes placed on the trade of food. In 2010, after a disastrous summer in Russia, many of you remember that Vladimir Putin put an embargo on the sale of wheat from Russia. Russia is the world's third largest supplier of wheat. And what happened was that not only were embargoes placed on the sale of grain from Russia, but other countries then became concerned that they were going to lose profits, that they were going to not be able to get the supplies they wanted. So embargoes appeared in a whole variety of other countries, and that automatically drove up the price of grain, all grains, not just wheat. They all moved together. And at the same time, with speculation in the commodity futures, and hoarding compounded the problem, and climate change further increased speculation. So this is a threat that has to be addressed. I'm not sure how we can overcome it, but it is a threat and a problem for the future. Fifth cause for increase in the price of food is one that, as I think is shameful, frankly, is the failure of the global community to appropriately invest in agriculture. Agriculture productivity is now too low to meet demand. And what you'll see is demand is increasing by 2 to 3% a year, whereas supply is increasing only by 1 to 2%. You can see on this graph, maize, that's corn, you can see the rate of increase is progressively declining, and it's true for rice and wheat as well, simply because there hasn't been enough investment put into agricultural development over the last 20 to 30 years. FAO put out the statement that official development assistance to agriculture decreased by some 58% in real terms between 1980 and 2004, dropping from 18% of total global aid to 3.5% over the 25 years. This has to be reversed. We can't succeed. We're not going to overcome the issues of food insecurity unless there are changes. And there are large initiatives underway in many funding agencies, in multinational food corporations, in NGOs and others, to invest in food security, invest in expansion of agriculture. But most of those, there's inadequate coordination amongst them, so they tend rather frequently to take rather narrow views as to what the need is, what the issue is that they want to address. Now, those are laudable, but we need to have more broad collaboration and interaction amongst these funding agencies and multinational food corporations to make the most use of the funds that are available. Finally, climate change and sustainability. Global warming will change farming as we know it. It's likely to have a largest effect in areas already experienced food insecurity and water shortages. geographic range of infectious diseases is likely to expand, and there's some evidence of that, that is already happening. There's a disease most of you have probably not heard of, but it's important in veterinary medicine, called blue tongue. Blue tongue used to be limited to northern Africa and some southern parts of Europe, but now, because of global warming, the midges that spread blue tongue have permeated most of Europe and even come up and invaded into Britain. And that is primarily attributed to the rise in temperatures in that part of the world. And as we already indicated from the first slide, extreme weather events will contribute to spikes in food prices and to acute and chronic hunger. So the food supply has to be resilient to weather fluctuations. It's one that has to go into the design of how we address this issue. Here's a map of winners and losers as a result of climate change. And what you see is that it goes from loss of 50% in productivity to the winners will get an increase of about 35% increased productivity due to warmer climates and higher CO2 levels. And if you look at the United States, it looks to me as if this is the Mason-Dixon line here. So if you're south of the Mason-Dixon line, doesn't look good for the United States, whereas the Union's probably going to come out all right and win yet again. But look at Africa. I mean, most of Africa, this huge potential reduction. This is by 2080. Somewhere it tells you that. I don't see it on the slide here at the moment. But climate change is going to devastate agriculture in Africa. India, what will be the most populous country on Earth, potentially a 50% reduction in food productivity as a result of climate change. How do you address that? It's an enormous problem. Part of Australia, already very dry, and these are all areas that are comparatively dry, are going to have severe consequences as a result of global warming. It's true in South America as well. Argentina is the one place that seems to be as if it's going to be somewhat resilient. So as we think about how you design food resilient programs, recognize the consequences of global warming. Now, I said I'd talk about livestock. Livestock are a significant contributor to greenhouse gas emission. So they're part of the problem, they're also part of the solution. Greenhouse gas emission has to be reduced if we're going to have agriculture participate in the factors that lead to global climate change and increase in temperatures. And one way to accomplish that is to reduce livestock numbers. And that can be accomplished by increasing efficiency of production, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions per unit of product. And remember that term, per unit of product, because that's the most important metric that you need to look at. And that's an environmentally responsible way to try and address, have farming address this issue. Large farms are generally more efficient than small farms. That's a generalization that is consistently true. Large farms also make use of economies of scale, reducing costs per unit of product. Now, I know in this country that large farms, consolidated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, have a bad reputation, and we in veterinary medicine and in agriculture have to do things to try and address these problems, because I don't think there's much alternative in many parts of the world but to increase the numbers of concentrated animal feeding operations, and I'll show you more of that in a minute. So look at this example, and I use it to show you how incredibly productive farming is in the United States. And I don't do that because I want to brag about the capacity of farming in the United States, but just to use it as an example of what can be accomplished and what directions we need to move in. So if you look at the United States in 1950, yield per cow, average cow, 664 gallons of milk per year. At that time, we had 22 million cows, 17.6 million heifers, for a total roughly of 40 million cows in the dairy trade. And one cow with that level of productivity, using the USDA figures to how much an individual, average individual would drink of milk a day, one cow could support 30 people. And at that time, per pound of milk produced, if you look at methane emission, because cows do emit quite a significant amount of methane, it was 0.0485 pounds per pound of milk. Now look what has happened today. It's gone from productivity, yield per cow has gone from 664 to 2,750 gallons per year. It's a phenomenal increase in productivity. And that's the result of much better knowledge of nutrition, of housing, of management, of disease control, many factors that have gone in to increase, raise the level of productivity. And because of that, then, the numbers of cows has reduced from 22 million to 9 million. You have to have heifers. This is your replacement herd that you constantly have to have. And that generally represents about 80% of the milking herd. So we've had a 60% reduction from 40 million to 16.2 million. And it's very obvious you're going to have a reduction in the release of methane when you have that level of decline in the numbers of animals. But look at the numbers of people that one cow could support using these metrics, 121. And also, per pound of milk, the level of methane has come down as well. So it's environmentally sensitive and responsible to move in this direction. But what you also see on the slide is China. Now, China is roughly where we were in 1950. Average cow in China produces 670 gallons of milk. I think that's a figure for 2005. I meant to put the reference in. In China, from a time 1985, it virtually had no dairy industry. Today, it has somewhere in the region of 15 million cows and increasing. And what they're doing is increasing the numbers of cows to meet needs and not putting the same emphasis on increasing productivity, increasing yields. Now that's the direction. Increasing yields is the direction that they have to go. The Chinese know this, and it will happen, I'm quite convinced, but this is where they are at the moment. And so you can see that they have, using the same figures I used for the calculations in the United States, 27 million animals, and presumably, if you can use American figures as to how much an average Chinese, how much milk an average Chinese person would drink, it would be about 30 people. India is the other. India is the world's largest producer of milk, by quite a long shot. It has the world's largest population of cattle. So look at the total number of cattle in millions in India, 304 million. They've got a staggering number of cattle. Just think for a minute for the amount of methane that all those cattle are releasing into the atmosphere. India has got to address this issue somehow, in my view. India is not efficient in terms of its milk productivity. Average cow, 300 gallons of milk a year. That's an incredibly small amount of milk that is produced. The dairy herd is 102 million. That's actually milking cows. I don't know how many heifers, I don't know how long they keep their animals in milk, and I suspect a long time. There's an enormous problem so far as cattle are concerned and environmentally sensitive ways in which food production has to proceed. So when you see these sorts of figures, I said it wasn't intended to brag about the productivity of American agriculture, but to make the point that there is a tremendous opportunity for increasing the level of productivity in the global south, in developing worlds. And I'll show you another example of that. It basically says exactly the same thing. This is animal productivity, this is meat production. And you can see Burkina Faso, which is an incredibly poor country on the west coast of Africa, and look at beef production. It's per carcass, per animal, kilograms of meat per head, 15.13 kilograms of meat per head of animal, compared to United States, 122.6 pounds. If you could just double, and I think it's eminently doable, if you can double the level of meat production by, in cattle in Burkina Faso, you can have a profound effect on the food security. The other problem, and it's true, I'm not going to go through each line there, you can read them yourselves, but we add to it that what Burkina Faso, it's got a very rapid population growth taking place in Burkina Faso. It's about 3.6%. And to meet the needs, what they have done is to increase the numbers of cattle by 360% in the last 30 years. But there'd be no increase in the yield per carcass, per animal. Well, you can imagine what that does. These are animals that are turned out on semi-arid savanna grasslands, and it destroys the grasslands, it destroys the pasture. So I don't know how this can be addressed, but it has to be addressed. We have to change the system so that there's much greater productivity and reduced numbers of animals in the herds in Burkina Faso. Brazil, I'll come back and talk about Brazil. It's a remarkable success story. You see the other countries, in terms of poultry, pork, and small ruminants. New Zealand, in particular, does better than us in some areas, in particular. And the same story goes for maize production. There's a phenomenal increase that's taken place in maize production in the United States in the last 50 years. And it's continuing. Today you get about, well, in I think in the 1940s, you used to get about 30 bushels of corn per acre. Presently, you get about 160, 170 bushels of corn per acre. The top yield this last year was a farmer in Arkansas who produced 311 bushels of corn per acre. So even our average can go further. But then compare that. South Africa doesn't do badly. But look at all the other countries with very small levels of productivity. This is important for animal nutrition. So this is important to the whole thesis that I'm talking about. Just they're very small. They're very inefficient. And what can we do to increase that level of productivity? It doesn't need to be at the American level, but if we can double it, you solve a great deal of the issues that I've been addressing. So methods of production and constraints. Supermarkets. I tend to think if you look at the penetration of the supermarkets in different countries, it gives you an idea of the way in which a country is going to develop in terms of its agriculture. So in India, for example, only 5% of sales are in supermarkets. Supermarkets have not made a great penetration, and that probably means that you're not going to have a great deal. Supermarkets are like to deal with large producers who are going to give them a continuous supply of a product that is of a uniform quality. That's probably not what's going to happen in India. As I've already indicated to you, India is the largest producer of milk in the year in the world, 100 million metric tons a year. That's a huge amount of milk. It has a fifth of the world bovine population, but it's got very low productivity. It has very well organized farmer cooperatives, and they have access to urban markets. So I think it's likely that India is going to expand on the village type, the small farmer type of productivity to solve the needs in terms of milk needs, milk supplies. that expanding productivity of small farmers, and what's important is that allows the Indian government to maintain the social structure, the social order, and that's obviously hugely important. And one of the ways that they are approaching this, and is particularly important anywhere in the world, is in terms of education of women. Women are in a hugely important aspect of food production, livestock production in the world. Increasing their education has multiple benefits. I don't have time to go into it. One of the other very interesting things that is taking place is the use of cell phones. Cell phones, the women have cell phones, and now there are systems that can tell the woman, the farmer, when they should sow their programs, when they should add fertilizer, when they should harvest, what the weather conditions are going to be like. So the impact of cell phones on education and progress of farming is likely to be very profound. And in fact, in parts of Africa, cell phones are almost being used now like credit cards, where money can be put in to a cell phone from different sources in response to various types of need, including crop insurance. There's quite remarkable things taking place. So there is some hope that this can be accomplished, but this isn't a country, I've already said to you, is likely to lose 50% of its productivity because of global climate change. And I think there's a huge concern has to surround India. China, food security and food insecurity. Beijing growth is a huge growth of the urban middle class, all living in these delightful high towers, apartments. But these people are relatively food relatively food secure. They have the resources to address food spikes, etc., when that arises. Now, what you find in China is that penetration of supermarkets is significant. It's well over 60%. In 2000, there were no supermarkets in China. Today, there is a huge number, and it's come from investment from foreign capital. And you see here, Walmart is one of the major supermarket chains in China. There are some Chinese chains as well. And as I've already intimated, supermarkets tend to be linked to large farming units so that they can get a uniformity in product. Now, one of the things about China is that China has 20% of the world's population, but only 7% of the arable land mass. So here's an example of what China is doing there. The middle class in particular are on a pork binge. A huge increase in the consumption of pork. And what you see is in blue, the Chinese, the production of soybean in China, it hasn't changed a great deal, but the imports have gone up, the domestic consumption has gone up. So here is what is happening on world markets as far as the soybean industry is concerned. And here you see in 2000, Europe imported from, this is from Brazil. It's an example of how China is having an impact on the global scene. China in 2000 imported 15% of Brazil's soybean trade. Brazil, by the way, is now the world's largest exporter of soybean. So this is a significant part of the soybean trade. So 15%, Europe, European Union, 64%. And look how it changed in 2009. China now dominates the world in terms of the soybean market. 56% of the soybean market going to China from Brazil. And as it does that, with its affluence, and with its dominance in the market, it plays a role in increasing the price of soybean. You should ask yourself the question, if we look in 2019, how much further around has this gone, and how much are other countries going to be squeezed out because of the dominance of a huge consumer such as China. But what I said was that China has this relatively small arable landmass. What they're doing is borrowing land in Brazil to feed their consumption at home. So what happens to the soybean? And actually, out of interest, soybean originates from China. That's where it first came from. So the soybean comes to to China, and it goes predominantly to industrialized swine industry. 80% of the increase in the pork production in China in the last decade has come from these large farming systems. They're usually systems in peri-urban coastal areas because they're importing all this grain into China. And they are large units, they employ economies of scale, but they come with problems. One, of course, it's extremely unhealthy to have such large animal facilities on the outskirts of cities because of disease control. And the other thing, of course, that happened is that now you don't have arable land that you can distribute animal waste on. And so it goes into these big ponds that you see here that are euphemistically called lagoons, and then invariably just released into streams and rivers to go out and pollute the South China Sea and increasing red tides, etc. So there are problems. Now, I should tell you that these sorts of lagoons, you can use the material. It's rich in energy, and you can install methane digesters and catch the methane and use the heat to heat the farm or to generate electricity, etc. And that's certainly going to happen. But when you do that, yes, you've caught the methane, but you've still got nitrogen and phosphorus in the effluent. And you're still going to cause pollution if you allow that fluid to go out into the streams and rivers. The way to remove the nitrogen and phosphorus is by reverse osmosis. And that is used in Denmark in the swine industry. But it's heavily subsidized by the government because it has been very expensive, the reverse osmosis. What is surprising is that the price of reverse osmosis is coming way down. And I think there's a reasonable possibility that this sort of disgusting lagoon is going to be a thing of the past in perhaps the not too distant future. At least I'm optimistic so far as that is concerned. And if you do that, of course, then you're going to reduce dramatically the health threats, because waterborne diseases are the biggest health threat for these sorts of peri-urban activities. But there's a social issue in China, and that is large units, though they are efficient, they marginalize small farmers. And the small farmers are major producers of pork in China. Large units disrupt the social system. And the challenge has to be as to how do you raise the level of productivity of the small farmer and integrate the small farmers into a food supply system. That is something that has to take place between the large producers and the small farmers. I think it's really the best solution is a mix of the very large producers and small farmers. But there's another issue related to this. The dairy industry. Now, I indicated that the dairy industry is the level of productivity is equivalent to the United States in 1950. However, the Chinese realize that what they have to do because of the limited land is to move to much larger production facilities. And this is a large dairy in China. The colleagues at New Bolton Center, we constantly have Chinese students over learning technologies, particularly related to nutrition, dairy nutrition, because that's what we focus on. My colleagues, Dave Galligan and Jimmy Ferguson, also consult with Wuxia Dairy, which is about 100 miles west of Beijing. And that's a farm with 3,000 cows. That's a big unit. Now, the problem So far as the dairy industry and increasing the scale of the dairy industry in China, is the average size of the farm in China is 0.32 acres. And if you are going to have a dairy, then your feed, you're going to have to import feed from Wuxia dairies, had to get supplies from several thousand different small farmers. And frankly, that's impossible to run a dairy in that way, because the feed is of all of different quality, different nutrient value. And this is the sort of thing that you saw, and that's actually a cart with what looks like very poor quality hay. And so astonishingly, Wuxia Dairies now imports all their hay from the United States, from Oregon. That's the level of problem that they have in China in trying to develop their industries. And what it means is that there have to be major changes in the industry and in farm ownership. There are too many people in the rural areas for the expansion of the dairy industry. So there has to be major reforms in China so far as land ownership and land tenure is concerned. And that clearly is going to be socially disruptive. But if you're going to even consider moving people from rural areas, you have to be able to figure out how you're going to provide non-farm income for these people. So there are huge challenges that China has to address so far as the increase in productivity of swine poultry and the dairy industries. Food security, food insecurity in the urban poor. Intimated how large this population is becoming. 1 billion people presently live in slums, and it's estimated that this will increase to 2 billion people by 2030, and that'll be in the developing world. Most of the slums in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. Now, employment to people living in slums is different. The needs are different, as I intimated right at the beginning of the talk. They have to be employed because they have to buy food with cash. And when the risk arises subliminally when they're unemployed. Food must be inexpensive, as inexpensive as possible, to allow these people to have some level of food security. And they're particularly vulnerable, as I already indicated, to price spikes. So one of the difficulties is that as you get the expansion of supermarkets, supermarkets tend to put out mom-and-pop corner stores, small providers. And supermarkets are not built in slums. So there's an issue of where the urban poor, the slum dwellers, are going to be able to get the food supplies from. And how do you provision slums with safe, affordable, and nutritious food and clean water? As already indicated, this is politically a hugely important issue. What system needs to be put in place? And that's one of the issues that I said at the beginning, there would be a conference between various schools, including the Veterinary School and the Institute for Urban Research, will begin to address these issues. Much of what happens in slums, certainly in Africa and in other parts of the world, the slum dwellers are supplied by street food. There is no inspection, there is no food safety, no quality control or anything that's available. And that system, I don't believe, can provision slums with a total of 2 billion people. Something else has to be discovered. So let me finish. I talked about a whole lot of problems. Let me finish, and I'm sorry I've gone on a little longer maybe than I should have, by talking just about Brazil. And talking about the Cerrado in Brazil, and you see that area outlined. It's an area south of the Amazon rainforest. It's an area that is three times the size of Texas. And in less than 30 years, Brazil has turned itself from a net food importer, including an importer of soybean, into one of the world's major food exporters. It is the world's second largest soybean producer. The United States is the largest producer of soybean. But Brazil, with a small population, is the number one exporter today of soybean. It is the third largest poultry producer, and it's the world's number one poultry exporter. It's the second largest beef and veal producer and the number one exporter. That's a phenomenal increase and change that has occurred in Brazil. And this has been done without deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. It's in this area that is known as the Cerrado, which is south of the Amazon rainforest. And it's an initiative that has been financed. It's a public-private partnership led particularly by the Brazilian Agriculture Research Corporation. That's the engine of growth that has taken place. I would say this is the world's number one tropical farming research institute in the world. It was formed in 1973, and the Cerrado was considered unfit for farming due to acid soils and poor nutrients. Well, what they did, and they were extremely creative in the way they went about it, they limed the soil for years. They put tons of lime on the soil to change the pH of the soils. And they bred various rhizobium so that they could plant these and fix nitrogen in the soil, so the nitrogen levels increased. They imported grasses, Brachyeria, from Africa. This is an African grass that they have used to create the soils, the fields that you can see here. They developed soybean, which is generally a rather cool weather plant, to be a tropical crop so that it grows extremely well in the Cerrado. And they pioneered new operational techniques, including no-till agriculture. I haven't got time to go into it, but that's actually a technique that is spread much more widely in the world and is extremely important. And they integrated arable and livestock agriculture, including integrating livestock with trees. And livestock do much better in this rather hot climate when they can get shade from trees. So you've got a win-win combination taking place there. So, as I said, Brazil has transformed itself as an agricultural producer. The techniques that they have are applicable in the Argentine, but I also think they're applicable for the savannah in Africa, in view of the fact that Brachyeria, the grass that is the predominant source of nutrition for livestock, originally comes from Africa. And with that, I'm sorry I've gone over time, but thank you.
Would you be willing to take a few questions?
Sure.
Right now?
Sure. I can try.
So you talk about, you know, Brazil, and I'm not sure if you're ending on using Brazil as the model that you know, other countries should follow. As, you know, in the U.S., we've increased productivity to an extreme amount, but it's come with the consequences of these, you know, CAFO operations. And in China, they seem to be headed along the same path of you know, high increases in productivity, but with these environmental repercussions. Has Brazil seemed to find, a model without these environmental effects, with an increase in productivity, but not to the same extremes?
Well, Brazil is you're not getting CAFO growth in Brazil. It doesn't have that type of intensive agriculture. This is extensive agriculture that they pioneered. And you should recognize, actually, when you see grass fields like that, they're phenomenal carbon sinks. So they have a very positive environmental impact. Now, I realize, as I said earlier on, that the CAFOs have a bad connotation, and we have to address that. But I think the issues of CAFOs can be addressed, and we can get more, we have to work to get more confidence on the part of the American public and the European public that all of the problems surrounding CAFOs can have been addressed and resolved. That's a challenge that we have to try and find solutions to.
You talk about disease, mm-hmm. and again, going back to the CAFOs, that is a source of disease from all of the pharmaceuticals that are being used unnecessarily.
The pharmaceuticals?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's my understanding that a lot of that comes from the feed that for the animals, because they aren't meant to eat grain. So, what would you propose? How would you propose to change the feed for the CAFO, for livestock raising CAFOs?
Well, chickens and swine eat grain. Cattle, you don't use a huge amount of grain in cattle production. 60% of the feed that a cow would normally consume has to be herbage, because you've got to generate the rumen. You've got to maintain the rumen. So, yes, there will be some, as you get increased intensification, there will be some grain, but it's not. It's a limited amount of grain that you use in dairy production. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure. Right. If you gave cattle just grain, they'll die. Your goal should be at least 60% should be roughage to generate the normal activity in the rumen.
Did Brazil's increase in production meet China's increase in demand? And if so, does this mean that there's hope?
It may have met China's increase in demand, but the question is, did it increase the demand from Thailand, from other countries? What is the threat on the global markets in terms of availability of grain and the cost of food? So as China increases in prosperity, it's going to have an impact on the price of food, because you're now looking entirely at global markets. There are huge levels of global movement of grains around the globe. And you have to wonder, so far as Brazil is concerned, they're widening the Panama Canal. Well, that would mean that larger grain ships from Brazil can make their way at less expense to China in the long run. So there are all sorts of very complicated and interesting issues that concern. Well, the problem so far as Brazil is concerned is that it's been extremely successful in productivity. It hasn't invested in the infrastructure. And I didn't talk about infrastructure, but roads and rail are hugely important when you've now got growth of urban communities and farming taking place at long distances. You have to have efficient rail or road communications. Brazil didn't. They didn't invest in it. And so there's a long lag time between production and getting to the port and getting shipped to China. And that's a problem that Brazil has to address.
You were speaking earlier about famine and the it wasn't really a problem, the shortage of food, but rather the volatility of the market and prices and access. And you are speaking about one of the solutions to global food insecurity is being international investment in agriculture. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious what specifically that looks like, that international investment, if that's, you know, investment in technology or rather like fortifying national food sovereignty and
You want to have it as open doors as possible. In 2011, when you had a food spike, in fact, there was adequate food available, but people were hoarding it, there were embargoes, etc., and that's what created the food spike. It wasn't that there wasn't enough food. There was. If we worked coordinately amongst different countries, and that's what we're going to have to do, then you can provide food where it is needed. And that's the whole story for eons. Mao Zedong caused the biggest famine ever. 30 million people died, and that's because of a policy that he introduced away. I don't know what the date was that the Great Leap Forward was introduced. But he caused massive starvation in the Chinese people. It's just one example of time and time again. This is what happens. So open dialogue. If we could get rid of food subsidies, it would help an awful lot, particularly in the developing country. I don't understand the farm bill in this country. Don't ask me to explain it to you. We spend, I don't know how many billions in the farm bill, but that's protection. And it's not healthy, in my view. Mm-hmm. Katie?
I think I have to wait
You ended with a hopeful note about the Cerrado in Brazil, but Brazil also has a notorious slum problem. So how do you see increasing production being coupled with urban food supply? Because Brazil didn't seem to do that. Did the Cerrado cause any of the slum?
I don't know that I would agree with that, because actually the slum population in Brazil has declined significantly. I didn't show the histogram of Asia and Africa. Well, the one for South America, there's a significant decline in the incidence of slum dwellers in South America, and that's predominantly Brazil. So I don't know all the reasons how they've been successful, but there has been a decline. And I can't help but think that the success of the Cerrado had to bring prosperity to that country.
So, Dr. Kelly, you talked about the difference between different countries and how some are going, like India is going more the route of village production is increasing, whereas in China it's more the supermarkets coming in. Mm-hmm. So do you think that there's a, do you think in general, overall, that small farms hold more potential to meet the gap in supply? Or is it more a country-by-country basis?
It's a country-by-country basis. I mean, part of the reason for showing it is that you can't make generalizations. Every country is different. You've got to look at the individual country to see the direction that it's going to go in. It was actually, and I didn't make the point clearly enough, so thank you for asking it, there's great variation, and I didn't talk at all about Africa. I really didn't have time. There's huge variations from one country to another.
The figures I've heard for ethanol production from corn is it takes about 1 gallon of petroleum to produce a gallon of ethanol, and 1 gallon of petroleum to produce ethanol from sugarcane. Are these figures correct? And
I don't know. I can tell you that the sugarcane industry in Brazil is the most efficient of the ethanol producing programs that there is.
Do you view the mandate for corn ethanol in our gasoline today as a subsidy that is hindering the food supply? You mentioned the switch to non-competitive species. Is the model that we have in the United States for ethanol production, which is corn, does it need to be changed?
I certainly think it is, because I think it's an enormous problem when you've got the price of corn tied to the price of gasoline. As the price of a barrel of oil goes up, then the price of food goes up directly, and I think that's not a good relationship. So, I mean, we're hopeful that, as I said, switchgrass and other methods of production will come along and replace corn. I mean, part of the reason for the price spike in 2008 was because there used to be large reserves of corn in the United States that were used to offset sudden instances of hunger. Well, they've all gone. And so when you got a price spike, you couldn't offset from the reserves that we had in this country. That's no longer available, and it's been a thing that has been important for many countries, the largesse of this country, providing food in emergencies. It's no longer there. And this sort of, as I said, price spikes are going to continue, I think almost certainly, as a result of extreme weather conditions.
Okay. Just wanted to thank you for a really enlightening presentation and looking at the global issues. I also wanted to mention that the issues here in Philadelphia are pretty substantial as well, and in our region, and that's a conversation obviously for another time, but there are almost a million people in this area alone struggling, and there are so many issues in the U.S. that we're dealing with in terms of food security and all of these production pieces. I'm sorry. So I wanted to invite all of you, and you as well, Doctor, to a September 13th Hunger Symposium that PhilAbundance is holding to talk about all of these issues on a more localized scale as well. So thank you.
Yeah, good. Good.
With that, I think we can thank Dr. Kelly for a very enlightening evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.